There's a message even in the music. A little less conversation, a little more action, please. Distinguished guests, fellow delegates, friends, I am delighted to be here with you in the Stormont Hotel for our 49th annual Spring Conference. Each year when I start to write my conference speech, I read last year's notes and I reflect on the political progress in the intervening 12 months. So that didn't take very long. However, for any of you hoping that that means I'm going to have a very short speech, I'm going to disabuse you of that notion. It's hard to believe, on a serious note, that we meet again this year, for the third year in a row, in the absence of a functioning executive and assembly, without any clarity or certainty regarding the likely outcome of Brexit, and without any clear pathway from the chaos in which we languish currently to where we urgently need to be. Just this week, also for the third year in a row, quietly and without almost any debate or scrutiny, absent of any real challenge or meaningful local input, a budget for Northern Ireland was laid in the form of a written statement at Westminster. A written statement, not even afforded the limited opportunity of an hour of questions that would be provided by an oral statement. This is not how we should be governed. It is not good enough, and it needs to change. Yet it passed by with barely a whimper. So accustomed are people becoming not only to the appalling dereliction of duty exhibited by the main political parties who have failed to find the necessary accommodation to allow us all to do the jobs we were elected to do, but also to the equally appalling dereliction of duty by our Secretary of State, who has made no concerted effort whatsoever to end this interminable drift, despite it allegedly being her top priority. Now, I confess I haven't seen Karen Bradley's to-do list, but if restoration of the institutions is indeed her top priority, heaven help those whose concerns are further down the list. Her claim in the House of Commons that she approached resolving this impasse with a laser-like focus is evidence only that we can now add lasers to the list of things the Secretary of State knows nothing about. Of course, the Secretary of State is not ultimately to blame for the current standoff between the parties. However, she is responsible for her lack of urgency to either get the Assembly restored or put in place alternative arrangements to deliver government if parties continue to refuse to step up to their responsibilities. When we met last year, we did so in the wake of the collapse of talks between Sinn Féin and the DUP. We had just published our Next Steps Forward paper, setting out a range of options to try to address the outstanding issues, options including the potential to legislate on key issues at Westminster, to re-establish assembly committees in parallel with talks. But perhaps the simplest and yet most fundamental proposal was that an independent chair should be appointed immediately and all party talks convened as a matter of urgency. Instead, we got nothing. No attempt or effort to re-engage the parties. A vacuum was allowed to open up and it was filled with recriminations, with claim and counterclaim as to whether there was a deal, a draft deal, an accommodation. And that argument has poisoned the atmosphere ever since and continued to cause rancour, even at the most recent discussions with the local parties. To be blunt, the time has long since passed for that argument to be put to rest. Irrespective of what anyone thought or hoped at the time, whatever happened in the lead up to the 14th of February last year, it clearly didn't work. Had it done so, we would be here today in different circumstances. We would be talking about progress to deliver legislative change, such as Kelly Armstrong's private members' bill on integrated education, or the decisions on key infrastructure projects from the A5 to the North-South interconnector, for which she has lobbied strongly. Paula Bradshaw would be telling us how the necessary legislative and policy reforms to deliver the Bangor recommendations for health, which she has championed, have been implemented. Trevor Lunn could update us on delivery of licensing law reform to support hospitality and tourism, and on the actions being taken to renew and refine the mitigation measures needed to protect people from the worst effects of welfare reform. Chris Little would be reporting back on progress made by the Independent Review of Education, which he called for to address financial sustainability in our schools, and on implementation of the Special Educational Needs and Disability Act. We would have heard from Stephen Farry about the work actually being done to mitigate the impact Brexit is already having on research collaboration in our universities and on job creation and economic growth. And I think special thanks is due to Stephen for the leadership that he has shown and his persistence in that leadership on the issue of Brexit. Stuart Dixon would be here outlining the progress on prison reform started by David Ford and on work to ensure that the Farmer Report recommendations to keep families connected with prisoners are fully implemented. John Blair would be telling you how the Minister for Agriculture is responding now to the Brexit challenge faced by the agri-food sector and what progress there has been on the plans which he is demanding to tackle the even bigger threat to all of our futures that is climate change. And I would be updating you on progress to deliver a pension to those severely injured during the Troubles, people who carry the physical and mental scars with them every day, and those who care for them, often at significant detriment to their financial security. I would have good news too to share about the implementation of the Heart Inquiry recommendations to give recognition and financial support so desperately needed by those who are victims of institutional abuse. Perhaps the cross-party working group on which I sat before the collapse of devolution would have started to progress legislation to deliver equal marriage and finally bring us into line with the rest of these islands. But two-party talks to the exclusion of everyone else did not deliver. And so we aren't in that position. Instead, we're standing here over 1 year on, and while our assembly team and our staff teams have been championing all of these and dozens of other issues consistently and persistently, we hit the same brick wall of lack of a minister time and time again. Though we represent the concerns which we are confronted day in, day out, as we meet with our constituents, with local businesses, as we talk to local GPs and to people who work in our hospitals, as we visit schools and listen to parents, as we fill in universal credit claims and attend personal independence payment appeals. But we are denied the opportunity to effect any kind of change which is so clearly and so desperately needed. The kind of change that people have a right to expect, to demand. We can finger point and assign blame between the different parties until we are blue in the face, but it will not move us forward and it will not deliver the progress which our community deserves. And I, for one, think the public are sick and tired of bickering, of politicians fiddling while our public services and our economy burn. Because we are not simply standing still. With every day that passes, we not only lose opportunities to make progress, but we fail to stop the relentless deterioration in our public services, in business and community sector confidence, and in community relations. And we continue to erode the fundamental public belief in politics as a means to deliver the change they demand. All parties now need to focus energy, resources, and collective will to getting our differences resolved, our government reformed, and devolution restored. That's why in September, when there was no prospect of any government intervention, I initiated the first process to get all parties back in the same room. Not only was that the first time the main parties had been in the room for almost 8 months, but it was the first time, possibly since the Good Friday Agreement negotiations, that all of the parties and independents were actually included in any process. Whilst that initial meeting did not result in much agreement, nor did I expect that it would, it did achieve two things. It demonstrated that despite government reluctance, it is possible to get all the parties to the table. And it also made abundantly clear that a huge amount of heavy lifting is required to re-establish trust and relationships between parties before any executive will be restored. It was and it remains clear that we need a proper, structured and sustained process if there is to be any prospect of devolution being restored. In December, I travelled to a conference in Yale, and Senator George Mitchell spoke of a meeting with a group of paramilitaries who were engaged in talks to bring about a ceasefire in their own war-torn situation. The talks had faltered and stalled, communications had broken down, and things looked bleak. He asked one of their lead negotiators, "Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel?" Their reply, I think, sums up our situation perfectly. "Senator, there is always light, but right now there is no tunnel." With that in mind, and in the with the need for a process to lead us from where we are to where we need to be, and in the continued absence of any initiation by government, I again convened a round of all-party discussions in January. Again, every political party participated, and this time we managed to get agreement with all of the parties on two things: that we should continue to meet more regularly as party leaders, not a great step forward, but better than where we've been, but also that fundamentally, if the Assembly is going to return, the institutions and governance arrangements require significant reform. Because while the Assembly Chamber has lain dormant, save for tourists and visitors, for the last 2 years, the same cannot be said of the Senate Chamber at the opposite end of the building. There, under the scrutiny of the Renewable Heat Incentive Inquiry, any remaining doubts that the executive was dysfunctional have been swept away by a tide of evidence of the depth and scale of that dysfunction. Our experience in previous executives and our complaints about lack of collective decision-making and responsibility within the executive, about other parties' special advisers and party apparatchiks wielding greater power and influence than their ministers, about lack of accountability of ministers to the Assembly, and about the at times utter disregard shown to due process, openness and transparency, were once simply dismissed by both the DUP and Sinn Féin as whinging. Well, no longer. That our concerns were based in fact has been exposed under the forensic questioning of Sir Patrick Coughlin and his inquiry panel, whose incredulity at the lax approach to record keeping and the contempt of those in power for proper procedure was visible throughout those public hearings. When we opted not to re-enter the executive in 2016, unless there was significant reform and an equally significant change of attitude, we were right to demand better than what had gone before. And yet even we... And yet, conference, even we were unaware of just how far from the expected standards of good government the largest parties in the executive and the DUP in particular had departed. The inquiry report due later this spring will not make edifying reading, I suspect, and few, if any, of those involved in the RHI scheme will emerge covered in glory. However, it is important that we use it to learn lessons for the future, not simply to rake over our past. Not least among those lessons is the danger to good governance and the threat to government itself posed by a presumption that the only thing which matters is appeasing the demands of the two main parties, and in which even civil servants felt pressured to protect them from criticism and scrutiny rather than upholding due process. That's why last month we published our Better Government proposals, and we have now sought meetings with all the other leaders to discuss our proposals for reform, because if and when there is a return to devolution, it has to be based on openness and transparency, on proper accountability for ministers and advisers, on collective responsibility and on raising standards throughout government. Only with genuine reform of the petition of concern, replacing parallel consent with weighted majority voting, and restructuring the executive to enhance and incentivise cooperation, will we have an Assembly and executive which is not just restored, but which is fit for purpose, fit to deliver, and sustainable in the longer term. conference talks to achieve that must start now. We need an independent chair to convene them, someone with the impartiality to command respect, with the focus to drive the process, and with the authority to call it if the parties fail to either agree or engage seriously. And if parties refuse to come, then they should not be paid. And if it becomes clear that there is no will to restore the Assembly, then it needs to be shelved and alternative arrangements put in place to make the decisions, as we cannot go on in a state of suspended animation forever. That process cannot wait, as some would wish, until Brexit is over, because whatever happens in 27 days' time, it is clear that the slow-motion car crash that is Brexit will not be over, it will merely be beginning. Negotiating our future relationships in the world and planning for all of the contingencies will continue to consume the time, energy and resources of government for years to come. Just imagine, conference, that investment redirected towards building a sustainable economy, tackling health inequalities and poverty, and investing in education for our young people for a modern digital revolution. It would create the kind of vibrant economic powerhouse which would benefit not only the UK, but also Ireland and the rest of Europe. Instead, government spends millions of pounds of taxpayers' money preparing to deploy the army in the event of no deal, stockpiling essential supplies, staging practice customs traffic jams, consisting, I believe, of 57 trucks and a stray bin lorry. Making contingency arrangements for shipping involving a ferry company that has no boats and whose terms and conditions were cut and pasted from a fast food delivery company. And people yesterday were being issued with international driving licenses written in Barrow, to which their photograph was glued with Pritt stick. In something more reminiscent of 1950s Blue Peter than the sixth largest economy heading into the 2020s. If Armando Iannucci had written this as an episode of The Thick of It, it would have been rejected for being far-fetched. However, as a result of this folly, we are embarked on a regressive path, one which is insular and backward-looking, which ignores the peace and progress of the last 70-odd years in favour of jingoistic nationalism, which denies us the continued benefit of working closely with our European partners, neighbours and friends. There has been a lot of talk about hell of late, about who has reserved their special place and how. I'm not going to add to that today, conference. However, I'm going to change an old adage that says the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Well, I disagree. The road to hell is paved with nostalgia for a glorious past that never existed in a globalised world which has utterly changed. The Brexit people voted for can never be delivered, because for every Leave vote, there was a different version of Brexit. While that is a fine strategy to win a referendum, it is a less effective means of creating cohesion about the kind of future we have post-Brexit. They were promised a deal that doesn't exist. If there was a Canada Plus or a Norway Plus Plus, why would Canadians and Norwegians settle for less? They were promised a Brexit that would deliver £350 million a week to the NHS, when instead the EU nationals who are working in an already overstretched health service are leaving in increasing numbers since the referendum, all predictable, but none of it put on the side of a bus. In short, our membership of the EU is a racehorse, which is being traded for the promise of a unicorn. And so whatever donkey Theresa May brings home from Brussels will never satisfy the expectations either of those who voted unicorn or for those of us who just want to keep the racehorse. The tragedy of all of this is that many of those who voted for Brexit did so out of genuine anger and frustration that their area had not benefited when the economy was booming, but suffered hugely when it failed. They have borne the brunt of government austerity, whilst those who caused the banking crash and financial crisis walked away scot-free. Their concerns are legitimate, but their problems are not the fault of the EU, and Brexit is not the solution. Now, even the most... Now, even the most ardent fans of Brexit admit that we will all probably be worse off for about 50 years after Brexit. Every credible economist predicts that those areas which are currently poorest will be worst affected by Brexit. Just how angry and frustrated will those people be to yet again be the ones who shoulder the greatest burden? Why those who vocally champion Brexit offshore their hedge funds, are insulated by inherited wealth, or stand to make a fortune playing the currency markets, or when their vulture capitalist companies come along to feed on the carcasses of the businesses destroyed. Here in Northern Ireland, whilst Brexit did not cause the collapse of our Assembly, it undoubtedly added to the strain, and without question has made restoration more difficult than would otherwise have been the case. The courts may rule that leaving the EU does not breach the legal terms of the Good Friday Agreement, but common sense tells us that the entire premise on which the Good Friday Agreement relied was that of increasing collaboration and interdependence, of frictionless movement of people, goods, services and capital, and of the diminishing focus on borders and nationalism across the EU. Nowhere in the EU was that model more important, and nowhere in these islands will departure from it be more keenly felt than right here. Yet in an act of gratuitous self-harm, the very people who claim to value the union above all else, the DUP, backed Brexit, and in doing so put the question of the Irish border right back at the centre of our political debate after years of diminishing focus under functioning devolution, a situation which Sinn Féin have predictably and gleefully exploited. Still the DUP, giddy on their newfound notoriety among the ERG set in Westminster, are now touting and ignoring the irreparable damage that an ERG-style hard Brexit will inflict on Northern Ireland, a region which opposed any kind of Brexit, hard or soft. And if you doubt that they're giddy, look no further than the MP for this constituency, who admitted he voted the wrong way this week on a key amendment because he was, and I quote, caught up in the carnival atmosphere of the votes. Votes that will determine our economic and political future for generations. It would be nice to think that those voting were taking them slightly more seriously than ordering candy floss or having a ride on the Helter Skelter. We have been clear from the outset there can be no good Brexit, but if it's going to happen, a no-deal Brexit would be the worst possible outcome. Parliament has failed over the last 2.5 years to articulate clearly what it wants. Another 21 months extension to this process would merely prolong the damaging, paralysing uncertainty. If, as votes suggest, a majority of MPs actually oppose no deal, then they need to get on and back the withdrawal agreement, which is the only basis for a deal. And if Parliament are not up to the job, fine, put it to the people. Let's have a people's vote, but this time, one based on the real choice between the donkey on offer and the racehorse we have, not the unicorn which never existed. So while at Stormont and on Brexit, little has changed or progressed, there have been significant changes within Alliance in the last year. David Ford retired in June after 20 years as a member of the Assembly. David, I want to thank you for your service to the Assembly team, for your continued willingness to contribute and advise while always avoiding Monday morning team meetings. David's retirement has freed him up to become our local government election organiser in Antrim and Newton Abbey. As many of you will know, there has never been anyone in the history of the Alliance Party, or perhaps even in the history of politics, who gets more excited at the prospect of an election, and an STV election no less, than David Dawes. So I look forward not only to hearing about how many extra seats we gain in Antrim and Newton Abbey, but also the precise number of votes and transfers at each stage to at least two decimal places. At the Assembly, we were joined by John Blair, who has not only tackled his new role in the constituency with real energy and focus, but has also made himself an indispensable part of the Assembly team over the last 8 months. Given John's background in fisheries and inland waterways, his interest in rural development, and years of environmental and community activism, he has brought fresh drive to the agriculture, environment and rural development portfolio, building on the work which David had been doing. Of course, for us, John's selection as MLA seemed rather unremarkable. For years, he had served as a local Alliance councillor, building up his reputation as a capable advocate for his constituents. However, his selection was also a moment of history, as he became the first openly gay member of the Northern Ireland Assembly, another barrier demolished by this party, and another step towards the more representative and inclusive Assembly to which we all aspire. I also want to congratulate Councillor Julian McGrath, who replaced John on Antrim and Newton Abbey Council, where he set the ground running and has established himself as a very worthy successor to John and a very valuable member of our team. Of course, not all change comes about in such a positive way. And since last year, we also mourned the passing of Councillor Barney Fitzpatrick after a long period of declining health. Despite his illness, he continued to attend and participate actively in council business and to serve his constituents to the end. His funeral service, attended by political representatives from right across the community, was a fitting tribute to a man whose entire life was dedicated to public service and who lived a shared present while he worked to deliver a shared future. Born in West Belfast, he was an Irish-speaking member of the RUC and then the PSNI for 38 years. Shot by the IRA while on patrol during the Troubles in an incident where two of his colleagues died, he then retired and went on to serve his community as a local Alliance councillor and as an active member and lay server at his local church, St Mary Star of the Sea in Port Stewart. Like so many people in Alliance, he was a man who challenged sectarianism by his very being. Someone who didn't fit neatly into any box, who wasn't easily labelled or pigeonholed, but saw the community as one community and saw his role as serving it. He is hugely missed by us all. Having been selected to fill the council vacancy, Councillor Chris McCaw has continued that tradition of standing up for and defending safe and shared communities, not least in relation to the recent spate of racist incidents in Portrush. And of course, the last year saw a change too in positions of responsibility within the various councils. Nuala McAllister ended an outstanding year as Lord Mayor of Belfast, Carol Hard completed her term as High Sheriff, and Emmett McDonough-Brown commenced his year as Deputy Lord Mayor. In Lisburn City and Castlereagh Council, Tim Morrow handed over his mayoral chain at the same meeting where Amanda Grahan was installed as Deputy Lord Mayor, and I was proud to be there to celebrate with both of them. And last but by no means least, Councillor Gavin Walker concluded a hugely successful term of office as Deputy Mayor of Ards and North Down. To all of you who completed or commenced your term of office this year, thank you for the time you've invested and the impact you've had in office for your community, but also for Alliance. Each of you, each of us, are from very different backgrounds, with vastly different experiences, working in different day jobs, juggling different family commitments, facing different challenges. But what unites you all, what unites us all, is the commitment to the values and vision of Alliance and a passion for shaping our community for the better. Alliance's record in local government, as you have heard this morning, is strong, driving openness and transparency, challenging sectarian carve-ups, promoting diversity, good relations and equality, supporting economic development, protecting our environment, and creating safer communities. With council elections exactly 2 months away to the day, it is crucial that we focus our energy and resources in the next 8 weeks to ensure that the one tier of government which is working continues to deliver, and that we increase the influence of Alliance right across local government to make it deliver better. We don't do that simply because we want Alliance to win, which we do, but we do it because when Alliance wins, the people of Northern Ireland win too. Today we have seen just a small selection of the people who are standing for election in our party political broadcast, our candidate videos, and in our panel debates this morning. They are inspirational people, and they represent the broadest cross-section of society you will find in any local party. They are regular people who live and work in their community, who share the same hopes and fears for the future as their neighbours, and who not only understand, but who share the frustration and anger that people feel with the state of politics right now. They are people who believe rightly that our community deserves better. What sets them apart, what makes them special, isn't a privileged background or powerful connections, but their determination to not just believe that better is possible, but to step up, roll their sleeves up, and do the work to deliver it. Because better is possible, but it is not inevitable. We have to make it happen. We have to choose it. We have to demand it. In just 2 months' time, every voter will have a chance to do just that. We can cast our votes, as we always have, and we will get more of what we have now. Or we can cast our votes for Alliance and demand better. We have just 8 weeks left to get that message out there. Grasp this opportunity. Knock the doors. Address the envelopes. Support your candidates. People demand better. It's up to us to deliver it. Thank you.